Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. They announced what they're going to impeach the president for: obstructing Congress, which I didn't know was a crime, and abusing his authority. Now, I'm not sure what they base that on. I mean, that's not a high crime or a misdemeanor. It's based on secondhand information that somebody heard somebody said. And Schiff said, well, we got to impeach him now or he'll win the 2020 election. That seems to be their main concern, they've spent 4 years investigating rather than legislating. They should be required to return their salary for this four-year period because they haven't been doing their jobs. Well, with that said, we've been talking about mysterious disappearances. Now, this next disappearance, on the one hand, is mysterious. On the other hand, got a decent idea where he went. It's the story of the man known as D.B. Cooper, probably the most famous pseudonym a missing person ever had. The interesting point is his name was not D.B. Cooper, it was Dan Cooper. Now, the media called him D.B., and you know how the media is. If they say it, by God, it's going to be true. Now, a number of true crime shows have tried to figure out what happened to the man. All records of the event are based on the flight attendant and the passengers on board the aircraft. When Cooper got on board, he was wearing a dark suit with a black tie, very conservatively dressed, looked like a business executive. But during the flight, he called one of the attendants over and showed her he had a bomb in his briefcase. And when the plane landed in Seattle, he requested $200,000 in unmarked bills be given to him for the release of the passenger. He wanted four parachutes and food for the crew. And when those demands were met, he allowed the passengers to leave the plane. Now, there were three pilots and one flight attendant on board the plane when it left Seattle. Plane started south, and authorities presumed Cooper had the intention of going to Mexico where he'd live without fear of extradition. It was dark by the time they took off and starting to rain. I mean, the weather was not good. 40% of the flight, the cockpit, and the last thing she saw was Cooper. for putting on one of the parachutes and tying the $200,000 to him. Cockpits got a signal that the rear staircase of the plane, which was for emergency purposes, had been opened. And the presumption is Cooper used those stairs to get far enough out of the plane to jump. Now, that would make it appear that he was an experienced parachutist. Which, of course, unless he got his training in a civilian school, would necessitate he's former military. The plane landed in Portland. Stared down and two of the parachutes were still on board. And the black tie was sitting on one of the seats. Well, immediately a helicopter and C-130 were launched from a nearby Air Force base. And about 1,000 troops were selected ahead of the landing site for the where they assume he jumped. Planes were used to lower the staircase and drop weights and see where Cooper might have landed. But at the time, no evidence was ever discovered as to whether he made the jump alive or if he did, where he might have gone. I've got an interesting theory. Suppose the flight attendant and the pilots were in on it. Why would the plane need three pilots? I don't think those questions were ever investigated. Now, in 1980, north of Portland along the Columbia River, a young boy was out digging up the sand to build a fire pit. He uncovered three bags of cash, which was just below the surface of the area where he was digging. Rubber bands were still around the cash. Police took the bundles into evidence and compared the serial numbers to the money in the Cooper hijacking, and they were found to match. Discovery sparked a new interest and theories in the case. The best theory was that Cooper landed in the river but was separated from the cache, and he died and was swept away by the river. Now, in 2007, Special Agent Larry Carr wanted to finally solve what happened and discover the identity of D.B. Cooper. He was told he couldn't use government money or time pursuing the matter. So in an attempt not to use any of the time or funds, he decided to release previously unshared details about the case. And this brought in the Cooper Research Team in 2008. They set up a website, and for 3 years, they conducted an investigation. But at the end of that three-year period, they still had no idea who D.B. Cooper might be. Now, the name didn't link to a real person matching the description of the witnesses on the plane. There was no one either in Oregon or Washington that was ever reported missing that could match Cooper's description. So not only is the man known as Dan D.B. Cooper a mystery in terms of his real identity, but almost 50 years later, they still have no idea who he was. Now, if he was an experienced skydiver, then it's reasonable to assume he would have lived through the jump. Others have attempted the same jump he's supposed to have made in order to prove that it could be done. And if he didn't have experience skydiving, then it was thought he most likely died in the woods and his body was simply never found or swept out to sea if he did fall in the river. There's one problem with where the steps were stated to be put down and when the flight attendant looked to see if Cooper was still on the plane. The timing doesn't fit with being over the Columbia River based on the flight path. And it was proven the flight path given by the pilots was accurate. And the other mystery surrounding the entire concept of Cooper and his hijacking robbery scheme is the money. While some of the money was found along the river, not all of it's been discovered. And none of the money's serial numbers were ever put into circulation that the feds could prove. Now, the monetary system records all serial numbers, which banks keep records of, particularly if funds are eventually sent in for destruction. The fact that not even one bill, other than those found by that young man, ever came back into the monetary system, so that would suggest that Cooper didn't live through the jump. Now, it seems unlikely he'd go through the entire process, survive the jump, and go back to work on Monday following Thanksgiving. He was successful in the robbery. Though I will have to say, even in 1971, $200,000 wasn't going to go a long way. It also seems unlikely he'd just be sitting on the money when the legal ramifications have long since passed. Now, one theory that does make sense is he did live through the jump, made his way to Mexico or Canada, and exchanged the funds in a place that wouldn't have ready access to news about the robbery. And the money simply didn't make it back in circulation to the foreign exchange location. The fact is, there are a lot of unlikely scenarios, but it, also these scenarios that made Cooper's robbery one to discuss. Now, for those who spent a little time researching the case, many believe he was a Canadian citizen with military experience, skydiving experience, and he was a gentleman who could live comfortably on his usual salary. Under this theory, many feel he probably had an issue, maybe a gambling debt that needed about $200,000 to solve. And if he did have such a problem, then it's likely those who got even a partial payment would have laundered the money in a way that wouldn't reappear in the hands of the U.S. government to, or could be traced back to anybody. Of course, this scenario doesn't fully explain the situation, including why some of the cash was buried by the river and testing of the time frame for it to be buried along the river has never been conclusively proven either. At most, the burial time frame due to tests is a few years, not the 9 years from the time Cooper had it and when the money was found. Now, if you've got a comment, you want to be involved in the discussion, 267-521-0159 is the number to call. Now, for those who spent time, if you could find that $200,000, and you turn it into the insurance company, the most they're going to give you as a reward is $20,000, about 10%. Now, a tale like this, as a true crime with plenty of theories, will continue to spark the interest of the public, and some will hope to be the person that solves the case, because you could get a book and a movie deal out of it. Another just want to prove if any part of the story is false, such as whether one of the flight crew was in on the robbery concept. For all we know, the person saying Cooper wasn't on the plane and he jumped was a part of it. Of course, the FBI has considered it. Long and the short of it is, they have no idea what happened. Now let's go to what's been called the Missing Texas 40. In Montgomery County and Liberty County, Texas, they can't decide if it's a serial killer or just a coincidence. There's been a high number of missing persons reported in those two counties. An enterprising individual interested in 8 missing cases mapped out the disappearances of the individuals of Liberty County. And the map would suggest a circular route around Liberty and Montgomery County, with Alexandria Loitzer and T.J. Murray as being outliers in terms of where they went missing. Until you look at the top 40 list, oh, there's a lot of missing persons. The author of Missing Persons of America mentioned 8 disappearances. Patricia Small disappeared in 2002. Lori Boffman disappeared in 2006. Stokely in 2008. Cynthia Washington in, a month later in 2008. Larry Baker in 2010, Alexandria Loitzer in April 2010, although she wasn't a resident of Cleveland, she was apparently in nearby Spring, Texas. T.J. Murray disappeared in October 2011 from Springs, Texas. And Edwin Clark, December 2011, disappeared from Liberty County. Now, the top 40 list includes 7 missing persons from Liberty County and 33 from Montgomery County. But you have to realize the list of 40 people starts from 1979. The next didn't until 1983, and then a third in 1986. And when you look for similarities in all the cases, it's known that since 2008, At least 7 teens have come up missing, with 6 of them traveling on foot. And most of the people missing lived in the towns of Spring and Conroe. Most important part of the entire list of 40 is that the majority were known to be on foot. Now, we're going to talk about the Baker and the Rodney cases. Now, they're not more important than the other 38, but their dates of disappearance is too similar to ignore. Rodney disappeared the 22nd of January 2008, and Baker the 29th of January 2010. As you notice, there's a 2-year time gap. Now, Larry Baker Sr. disappeared on January 29th, 2010, from Cleveland, Texas. Born in 1955, 54 when he disappeared. Weighed 175 pounds with a height of 5'11". Brown hair, hazel eyes, wore glasses, had a mustache at the time of his disappearance. Now, his nickname was Jake. He didn't go by Larry. According to the Charlie Project, Baker's family is still looking for him. And they hope eventually they'll get closure in the case, but even the Charlie Project doesn't have a significant amount of details regarding his disappearance. Now, it's highly likely that he's no longer alive. At the time of his disappearance, he already had several medical conditions, including high blood pressure and diabetes, and showing early signs of onset dementia. Family reported already suffered numerous strokes, so he's unable to walk very far. So the fact that he could have walked off into the sunset is a little far-fetched. According to the police report, he was seen on January 29th. His sister lived on the same property. Now, the report's not clear whether the property was a duplex or two homes or why she went to take him food. She did tell police she went to bring him food and saw him at that time. Already searching the case, think he left between 1 and 2 a.m., and none of the searches at the time ever found any sign of him. Now, in 2011, there was an update. There's a website called Missing Persons of America that discusses Larry Baker. And according to the author of the article, Larry Baker made a report asking for help from the police. Now, Larry told the author of the website he was contacted by Detective Brian Bortes, who stated Kelly Nickerson, along with another guy named Larry, buried Larry on their property. Nickerson's the brother-in-law of Jerry Baker. According to Jerry's report, Nickerson admitted to doing drugs with another guy and burying Larry on the property. Kelly Nickerson was the victim of a hit-and-run incident in Pennsylvania, where he moved in 2011. The man who came forward about the death said he decided to tell what he knew because Nickerson had left town. The detective in charge said cadaver dogs would need to be brought to the property Nickerson lived in during the disappearance of Baker. But after 5 weeks, the family was still waiting for the cadaver dogs to be brought in for the investigation. Now, Baker's disappearance is not the only one to happen in Cleveland, Texas. Rodney Stokely, 19, disappeared in 2008. Additionally, Antonio and Luz Rodriguez, a senior couple, were murdered in 2005, and the case wasn't solved as of the 2011 update. Now, there are rewards for any information regarding the two missing persons in the double homicide case, and there have been allegations made that police in Cleveland are not following through on these cases, maybe due to corruption. But sources are not provided in 2015 to substantiate the claims. The Cleveland Advocate also posted information toward the end of 2014 asking for information regarding Baker's disappearance. Families still hoping to find some clue as to where Baker or his body might be. Now, Rodney Stokely was described as a kind of, kind teenager. And according to Baker, Rodney knew Larry, and his angst to find information about Larry suggested Rodney may have met the same fate as his brother did only 2 years before. Now, there was Jerry and Larry. Larry's the brother that disappeared. Rodney went missing January 22nd, 2008. He was last seen leaving Brook Hollow Apartments after attending a party. Time was 12:30 a.m. Stokely used his cell phone to make numerous calls, including one to his girlfriend, but then it's assumed the battery died because there were no more calls. Cell phone calls were associated with a tower on Wells Road off of Plum Grove Road. Left his wallet, phone charger, identification, as well as his skateboard. He was 19, remember. Reports unclear where he left these items, but it seems likely he left them in the apartment where the party was going on. And there were no reports of any problems at the party before he disappeared. 2013, it appeared that there was going to be a solution. A body of a similar age was found in Liberty County while Stokely disappeared, but he's never been found. Looking at the entire list of 40 people missing, it's possible to draw conclusions that may not apply. Taking a look at the two cases that I just went over, the dates are similar, but the ages aren't. Profilers state most serial killers like to stick with a certain type of victim, although this isn't always the case. If you look at the Boston Strangler, he went from older victims to younger to older again. Kind of targets of opportunity, I guess you could say. The police are certainly not looking at the list in its entirety. They're keeping all the files separate. In many cases, they don't know or make an effort to find out about cases in other towns. And many of these towns are small towns, so reporting to a national database is not something these agencies tend to do. But it's easy to look at the big picture and think serial killer. One man confessed to murdering people in Montgomery, but DNA evidence ruled out those he called his victims. Now, posts are continually made on Facebook regarding the top 40 list with requests for anybody who has information to share it, as well as to help spread the information around in the event that somebody in the U.S. may have information. The list is not updated, but it does seem to be growing if the most recent disappearances indication. Danielle Sleeper disappeared March 21st, 2015. Likely she was on foot with her purse and phone. 32 years old, 5'7", weighs about 120, 130 pounds. Brown hair and hazel eyes, went missing from Montgomery County. A body was found March 25th, 2015 that was not Sleeper's. The remains are of a woman with waist-length hair, and Sleeper's hair was only shoulder length. But that body's never been identified either. Well, these missing person reports from this area are still active, and it's possible more people disappear. Now, this next case is a fascinating one. A few years ago, folks in a 7-Eleven, I think it was, in Florida, found a Polaroid picture laying in the parking lot of a young lady bound and gagged in the back of a van. And it was believed that was Tara Calico. She was originally considered a kidnapping victim when she went missing on September 20th, 1988, 19 at the time of her disappearance. According to witness statements, her last known position was 150 yards from her home in the Rio Community Golf Course located in Belen, New Mexico. I've been there many times. Media coverage during the incident lasted 48 hours. Many shows, including Unsolved Mysteries, A Current Affair, America's Most Wanted, and Oprah, aired details about this case. She's still missing, and the case remains unresolved. Now, she was last seen at 9:30 in the morning by her mother. Took her mother's bike, a neon pink Huffy mountain bike with yellow trim. She rode the bike along Highway 47. Report from a witness said somebody looking like Tara was on the bike at about 11:45 that morning. Distance was 2 miles from her home, and this was a daily routine for Tara, and she always took this route. Now, one witness reported seeing a light gray or white 1953 Ford pickup truck following her. Now, police don't know if the truck has anything to do with her disappearance. And police also state her mother's bike was never found. They do suspect foul play, but again, they have no evidence. According to family statement, she was supposed to be home by 12 p.m. She wasn't. Her mother wanted, she wanted her mother to come pick her up. She had plans that, to meet her boyfriend at 12:30. She had a class at 4 at the University of New Mexico. Working at a local bank while attending school to become a psychiatrist. And since she was planning returning home after her morning exercise on the bike, she left her purse, school books, and tennis equipment at home. The mother went out at 12:05 to find her. She followed her usual bike route. She never varied. She never saw Tara, but she did find the Boston cassette tape Tara had with her, 3 miles away from the house on the opposite side of the highway she'd last been seen on. Later in line, some straight highway found part of her Sony Walkman. This was found 19 miles east of Highway 17, close to John F. Kennedy Campground. And near the cassette tape, police found bike tracks and skid marks. Now, June 15, 1989, a Polaroid photo was found in Port St. Joe, Florida. There were two figures in the picture, an unidentified female along with a small boy. They were lying on the sheets and a blue striped pillow with tape over their mouths and their hands tied behind their back. That photo was taken in the back of a Toyota cargo van, white with no windows, thought to be late 1980s van. Studying the photo, police found the film wasn't produced until after May of 1989. Also visible in the photo was a copy of V.C. Andrews' My Sweet Audrina, a favorite author of Calico's. And there was a phone number written along the spine of the book, but police couldn't make out all the details. Now, if a gnat had a tattoo, advanced labs have the equipment to see what that tattoo looks like. There were 300 possible number combinations, but only 57 were valid telephone numbers. Trying to determine information about the photo, police discovered the girl was supposedly walking along a beach in Port St. Joe. Witnesses stated she was with several adult males who were giving her verbal orders, but no one can confirm the girl in the image is Calico, not even the FBI. As for the boy, he was thought to be Michael Henley, who disappeared in April 1988, close to where Tara lived. All the FBI can say about the photo is that the hairline and ear are similar to Calico, and the image shows a similar scar on the calf that she had. As for Henley, his body was found in 1990 in the Zuni Mountains in New Mexico. So it would seem unlikely that the boy in the photo was actually Henley. No reason to take him from New Mexico to Florida and bring him back and leave his body in the mountains, although certain photographic evidence suggests otherwise. Two other photos have been found with a girl who had duct tape over her mouth. One photo dated sometime after June of 89 due to the availability of the film. A second was dated after February of 90, again due to the film production. The second photograph of 89 had a similar pillow like that first photo found in Florida. The June 89 photo was found in Montecito, California. The third photo from 1990 had a woman bound with gauze. The photo indicated a man next to her as they rode on an Amtrak train. Well, police got information from witnesses about that white truck following Calico the day she disappeared. According to statements, two teenage boys in a truck had followed her and harassed her, and then they accidentally hit her. Investigators firmly believe the two boys took Calico from the scene, panicked, and killed her. Police also believe that many individuals were involved in covering up the crime, including the boy's parents. But, again, they could never confirm it with solid evidence. They've never identified the suspects. Police continue to believe that Tara's remains are near where she disappeared, but hidden well enough that she couldn't be found right after her disappearance. Tara's mother and stepfather lived in the same home she left that day for an additional 15 years. Her biological father died in 02. Her mother died in 06. Stepfather and siblings are still alive and living in Florida, where they moved 15 years after she disappeared. Now, police don't have solid leads on any suspects, But a white truck was witnessed around Terra Calico the day she disappeared. It was seen following her. Near bike tracks are also skid marks that would indicate the truck did in fact hit Calico and was responsible for her disappearance. The boys driving the truck are the police's number one suspects. The case remains open, and the boys suspected of foul play are now adults. And despite Tara's biological family being dead, the rest of her extended family continues to ask for answers. FBI and Sheriff's Department still have their hotline numbers posted for information. In cases like this, the photographs could be misleading evidence regarding Tara, but also be evidence in another kidnapping abduction. Police believe that they'll find her remains someday not too far from her home. And then maybe, can make her rest. Well, you know, when you're talking about missing persons, many times an announcement of a missing person is just that, a missing person. If more than one person goes missing, it usually ends up with the bodies found later or the people returning after an unreported absence to their families, coworkers, or friends. In general, it's hard for more than one person to go missing at the same time unless there was a major accident, like a car going off a bridge, going down a boat going down at sea, or some other scenario similar to that. But this next case involves what was called the Springfield Three. This was a very unlikely event in which three people disappeared at the same time. They went missing on June 7, 1992. Cheryl Levitt, Susie Streeter, and Stacy McCall. Last seen leaving 1717 East Delmar Street in Springfield, Missouri. Cheryl was the mother of Susie Streeter. Stacy McCall was a friend visiting Susie. Cheryl was 47 at the time of her disappearance, just 5 feet tall, 110 pounds, short blonde hair and brown eyes. She was a cosmetologist. Susie was 5'5" and 102 pounds, 19, with blonde hair and brown eyes like her mother. McCall was 18, 5'3" and 120 pounds. Now, Streeter McCall graduated from Kickapoo High School the day before the disappearances. Levitt spoke with a friend at 11:15 the day of the graduation, told the friend she's going to paint a chest of drawers. Streeter McCall was seen on June 7, 1992 at 2 a.m. when they left a graduation party at a friend's house. When the two girls went missing along with Cheryl Levitt, the police were able to track down that Streeter and McCall were seen in Battlefield, Missouri at some point during the night of graduation. Also found the two girls who decided to go to Levitt's house instead of staying over at the home where the party was held. Home of the friend hosting the party is very crowded, so the girls wanted to leave to go sleep comfortably where it was quieter. Police were able to ascertain the girls arrived at the home based on the clothing, purses, jewelry, and vehicles found at the Levitt house. Well, concern wasn't raised until 16 hours after the women were last seen. McCall's parents called police to report the disappearance. Additionally, friends and family began calling the Levitt home. Some even stopped by and entered the house, but nobody saw any of the three after June 7th. Police figured that about 10 to 20 people had gone through the house looking for Levitt and two missing girls. All police saw when they got there was a shattered porch light. No signs of a struggle. They did ascertain Levitt's bed had been slept in. Personal property of all three women inside the house, including purses, cars, money, keys, cigarette, and the Yorkshire Terrier that was the family dog. Now, Robert Craig Cox was considered a suspect by his own admission. He was a convicted kidnapper and robber, as well as a suspect in a Florida murder case. He told journalists he knew the Springfield Three had been murdered, buried, and would never be found. And he admitted to being in Springfield at the time of their disappearance. Cox stated he was staying over at his girlfriend's house, which was near the Levitt home. But he later recanted the statement to say he was actually at his parents' house, and the parents, of course, confirmed their son's alibi. With no direct evidence leaking Cox to the disappearance, he was never charged. At best, police could hold him with obstruction of justice or tampering with the police investigation since he seemed to be making media statements purely for the attention. He went so far as to say once his mother passes away, he'll finally reveal the truth of what happened to the Springfield Three. Now, the case has received 5,000 tips that have yet to prove helpful. In June of 97, a bench in Victims Memorial Garden in Springfield's Phelps Grove Park was dedicated to the Springfield Three. Disappearance has also been on 48 Hours, America's Most Wanted, Unsolved Mysteries, as a way to get information. 2011, Investigation Discovery Channel aired the case on their disappeared TV series. Excuse me. Springfield Police Department issued a statement in 2012 regarding their investigation. They explained that any and all leads are always followed, but any other suspects that have been named have been ruled out. Streeter family still offering a reward for the information regarding the three women is $42,000 and available should any lead turn into the one that brings the women home to the Streeter family and the McCall family. Now, in December 2010, Rick Norlin was hired to run a ground penetrating radar scan of the south parking garage at Cox Hospital. Numerous reports were made suggesting that the three women were seen around the parking lot or were simply buried there because it was such a close drive from the Levitt home. It was thought if Cox did murder him, he may have driven into the parking structure that was under construction at the time. Norman has a record of the scan results stating there's enough evidence to suggest that three bodies are buried under the parking garage. That area has not been excavated. Right now, there is a petition online suggesting the Springfield Police Department run their own scan and excavate the area so the parking garage theory can be found to be put to rest. A lot of people want to solve this mystery. Well, this next mysterious disappearance involves somebody named Brandon Lawson. He was 26 years old at the time of his disappearance. Disappeared August 9, 2013. He was 5'9" and 230 pounds. Last seen leaving his home in San Angelo wearing a yellow shirt, camo shorts, and white 2013 Air Max shoes. Worked in the oil field and already had four children. At 11:53 that evening, he and his common-law wife, Ladessa, had an argument. Lawson was going to see his father, according to a phone call between the two men. Driving on Highway 277 near Bronte, Texas, Lawson called his brother Kyle to say he needed help because his car had run out of gas, which was kind of an odd request. Kyle and his girlfriend Audrey called Ladessa to say Brandon was out of gas and needed to get Brandon's gas can to help him out. Ladessa said she'd leave it on the front porch before showering and going to bed. Apparently, she was really upset. Now, Kyle didn't have the money to purchase gas, so the plan was to pick Brandon up and take him to Stripes Convenient Mart. But things did not go as planned. Shortly after he called his brother, he called 911. He said he needed help and a cop. The dispatcher thought she heard him say, "I ran into somebody." Next thing that happened at night was a trucker who dialed 911, reported a vehicle parked crookedly on the road, making it a hazard to other drivers. Well, Kyle arrived at the scene at 1:10 a.m. The sheriff's deputy was already at the truck, but couldn't find any damage. It didn't look like it hit anybody. Keys weren't in it, and the cell phone was missing. According to Kyle's statements of the incident, while he was talking to a deputy who was thought to be unaware of the 911 call by Brandon, Kyle got a phone call from his brother. Now, he couldn't really understand what his brother said, but it sounded like he said, "I'm in the field." Now, Brandon Lawson had a warrant out on him, 2 years old, and he's just been told about the warrant. He was supposed to address the warrant the following week. And Kyle thought maybe it was the warrant that had Brandon hiding out in the field, so he didn't tell the deputy about the phone call. The phone records show that Audrey texted Brandon at 1:18 a.m. to warn Brandon that a cop was at the truck. Despite the various accounts and information in the news, a spokesperson for the sheriff's office said the dispatcher phone call was to 911 to say he was out of gas and not anything about hitting somebody. Next day, when Brandon didn't show up back at home, his father's, his brother's, or the truck, the family got concerned. Kyle and his girlfriend looked around the area after the deputy left, but Brandon couldn't be found. Deputy also drove around trying to see if there was anybody walking along the highway in an attempt to get help. Kyle and his family eventually told police that Kyle received a phone call while Deputy Neal had been at the truck. Now, reports don't make it clear if Neal knew about the 911 call at the time or if he'd arrived at the truck due to the trucker's phone call. What is clear about Brandon's disappearance is that Kyle did get a phone call from his brother that he didn't report until it was clear his brother was missing. And there was a 911 call that Ledesa saw on the cell phone records. And since the last time Brandon was seen by his common-law wife, there's been no activity on his bank accounts or his cell phone. A search was conducted around the area of the abandoned truck on October 23rd, 2013, but nothing turned up. No evidence that Brandon had been in a field or any place else nearby. He's missing to this day. Now, Lawson's case is considered cold. With no evidence and no new information, it's likely the case is there's a lot of things in this case that seems a little bit strange. First, Brandon was making phone calls. He made one to his father, his brother, 911. Now, the operator tried to call Brandon back after being disconnected during the request for police to help Brandon as a stranded motorist. And the evidence does show Brandon called Kyle after the 911 call. Now, if Brandon was in the field hiding out, why not come out after Kyle called? Pictures of the field taken at the time clearly show if Brandon was hiding in them, he would have seen the deputy's car drive off. So if he wasn't hurt and actually was nearby, why didn't he come out? Now, this brings up two possibilities. The first, Brandon decided to run because of the warrant out for his arrest. The information released to the public didn't indicate what the warrant was for, and that means the disappearance of Brandon could have been an elaborate hoax created by his wife, family, and him to help him disappear into Mexico since there's no extradition from there. The other possibility is that somebody pretending to help Brandon picked him up, took him someplace, killed him, and disposed of the body in an area police aren't looking. While one would like to believe in the family's request for information on Brandon as a missing person, they have admitted to withholding information from the deputy when the truck was found abandoned. So that calls into question the validity of the story that he just disappeared without a trace. Now, in a world of burner phones where a family can keep in touch, it's not unlikely for Lawson to be in hiding. Some reports say police did track his GPS 3 miles from where the car ran out of gas, but no GPS for that phone has come back on since. So we have to file this one under maybe. Now, cruise ships have been in the news. Unexplained deaths. Now we have a disappearance. Now, the term cruise vacation conjures up images of sandy beaches, clear blue ocean, and a lot of fun. For those who go on these little holidays with family and friends, there's little to worry about because everything is included and trips ashore can be planned for the utmost safety. And safety drills are held so everybody knows where the life jackets are, how to get to the lifeboats, and generally have a good time. And for the crew, it's time to ensure families, groups, and everybody on board for the vacation is having a great time. Often, there are multiple jobs for one single crew member based on what they were hired to do. And the best part of working on a cruise is being able to go ashore in various locations every time there's a day off. Well, for Rebecca Corium, getting a position as a Disney crew member was the next step in her already full life. She attended Plymouth University in the UK for sports science and Liverpool Hope University for childhood studies and youth psychology and philosophy. While at university and afterwards, she spent time working for Chester Zoo as well as working at the DoubleTree by Hilton. As a teenager, she applied to be a cadet and then during university worked as a staff volunteer for the British Army Cadets, kind of their version of ROTC, I suspect. And for 4 months, she was in Camp America teaching sports in Maine. In June of 2010, she started working for the Disney Cruise Line, spent 4 days training at Disney World Park in Florida, and took her first cruise to the Bahamas, visiting Castaway Cay on Disney's private island. She was on the cruise ship for 4 months before returning home for a two-month break, spent time with her parents. After her return to the cruise line, she joined up with the Disney Wonder Ship sailing from Los Angeles to Mexico. Ship also went from the Mexican Riviera and through the Panama Canal. During this cruise contract, Rebecca lost a family member. She was given 2 weeks leave to go back home to the UK for the funeral. And at the funeral was the last time her family ever saw her before she vanished. Now, if you got anything to add, I suggest calling 267-521-0159. Well, in March of 2011, she became one of the 171 people to disappear in the past 10 years from a cruise ship. The cruise ship she was on was traveling from Puerto Vallarta to Cabo San Lucas. She was 24 when she vanished. Now, little is known about what happened on board the ship. There is CCTV camera footage of Rebecca on March 22, 2011. She was on the phone at 5:45 a.m. in the cruise quarters. According to the image, she was upset while talking on the phone. Rebecca's father, Mike, told media, "You see a young boy approach and ask her if she's okay, and she says she's fine. Puts the phone down, puts her hands in her back pockets, and then took her hand out, pushed her hair back. All movements look normal, and after that footage of her walking out of frame, she's gone." Nobody knew she was missing till 9 a.m. when she didn't report for work. The crew annoyed her, as they say, meaning they tried to get her to respond to a ship broadcast. When she didn't, they started searching the entire ship as well as radioed the Mexican Coast Guard for assistance. Coast Guard lost the search, but reported they didn't find her. An interview Mike conducted with The Guardian 7 months after her disappearance, he said all he hears is the investigation's ongoing. No details given whenever they try to call in to see if anything new has come up. In order to keep public awareness up, the family started a website. But that hasn't proved fruitful. Due to the ship's registration in the Bahamas, an officer had to fly from Nassau to rendezvous with the ship. This was one man sent to interview the 3,000 crew members and passengers on board the ship. He also had to conduct forensic collection as well as the interviews. Mike and Ann, Rebecca's parents, flew to L.A. on the 25th to meet the arriving ship. They met with the officer who didn't actually interview any of the passengers. The cop was on the ship Friday and Saturday. He didn't get back to the ship to interview more crew members for a longer period of time or even question passengers. Apparently, he barely even interviewed the crew. The Guardian reporter conducting the October 2011 write-up took it upon himself to book a cruise to interview crew members in an effort to see if he could get the information. Cruise didn't go very well in terms of discovering information. Most of the crew members had to give a patented answer, "It didn't happen," which was most likely to keep the passengers from becoming panicked that someone could just disappear off the ship. It is alarming when a member of somebody's family disappears from a ship, but what's more alarming is the truth behind what most cruise lines would do about it. Kendall Carver is a man who lives in Arizona. Anytime someone goes missing from a cruise ship, he calls the family because he's the father of a missing daughter. His wife took Celebrity Mercury in August of 2004. The cabin steward reported her missing on the second day. She couldn't be found. The cruise ship did not raise an alarm, reported to the police who had been conducting a search for her, and said they put her belongings in storage and eventually donated them to charity. Carver reported her missing on a daily basis, but everybody told him to forget it. His daughter's case is still open. The cruise line in a public statement said there's little a cruise line can do to prevent somebody from committing suicide. With 171 cruise disappearances, Carver believes it's more than just suicide that has some of the individuals go missing on these ships. He's got theories, negligence, cover-ups, and murder. He's also done research into safety of cruises. According to statistics, a cruise ship has a 50% higher ratio than an American city of sex crimes. On one ship, there were 9 reported cases of sexual assault made to the FBI, and this was in less than a year. On board a ship without police, being in international waters and with workers who are underpaid from all over the world, Carver believes the cruise ship life attracts criminals. And he could well be right. Most cruise lines have security officers on board, other than Celebrity, at least at the time of his daughter's disappearance. These security officers work for the cruise line, so their loyalty is to the cruise line and not the person that goes missing. And cruise ship headquarters are also not going to reveal where the CCTVs are or how many are on board. Now, Carver says you can believe there are CCTVs everywhere, including on the Disney decks. So if Rebecca accidentally or intentionally went overboard, there would be a record of it. Guardian reporter also has a theory after spending time on the ships. Most of the railings on the ship are too high to accidentally fall off unless you climbed up on them. And the only deck that has low enough railings is on deck four. It's also a jogging track deck. The theory is Rebecca was on the track jogging after the phone call slipped, went overboard. But the reporter wondered why the security footage wouldn't show this since there are four cameras, two on the port side and two on the starboard side. The setup of the cameras looks as if it would capture the entire deck. Following up on his theory, he talked with a crew member varnishing the rails on that deck. The crew member told the reporter no, his theory was wrong. Instead, he suggested she fell from deck five, which public access shows is totally indoors. When he questioned this, the crew member told the reporter to go up to deck 10 and look over the front of the ship. There's a crew swimming pool on that deck, and her slipper was found near the pool. But when the reporter went to the deck, there's a high metal wall surrounding the railing, too high to plausibly consider she just slipped. He also found out there was a tape of the phone call she made, but the cruise line won't share it because of the open investigation. Most of the people the reporter interviewed that were part of the crew, including a close friend figure, think Rebecca simply had an accident. Disney most likely knows what happened, but no one would share it due to hurting the brand. If she fell accidentally, then crew members watching the cameras would have seen it. If they didn't, then there's probably a cover-up of why they didn't realize she fell overboard. There is evidence to support that the cruise line would know exactly what happened. The crew areas record all images via CCTV. They also record ID cards. Down by the crew pools, the HR office, crew gym, and crew office, which monitors the documentation, money, and passports. All this security suggests that there's more known than what's being said. Unless the police investigation is closed due to solid evidence or a body found, the more likely scenario is the family will not have the closure they seek. Now, it is possible Rebecca had an accident on board. It's possible, although unlikely based on her character, she might have deliberately jumped overboard. Sometimes a family's not willing to see or admit to the full evidence they have simply because they can't believe their child, a family member, would commit suicide. Resolution 4 years later has not occurred. Sparked unfounded sightings of Rebecca in a lot of places. Family's still asking for the police to re-interview crew members, and the aquarium's offering a reward of $75,000 to whoever will answer what happened to Rebecca. In a 2014 interview with Dawn Taplin, a 17-year career policewoman was revealed as she started investigating. She asked the cruise line if there was a suicide note, and the member said no. She asked if there was a diary, and there was. Taplin said the Bahama police should have conducted more interviews and foul play in Rebecca's case should have been considered. Disney's response to the interview was that everything will be revealed in court. While the article didn't make it clear, it may be a lawsuit against Disney made by the Corum family who is simply trying to get the answer as to what happened. And of course, probably the most famous disappearance was Natalie Holloway, a high school teenager who went to Aruba with her class and vanished. Now, the body's never been found. The young man that they believe killed her is in prison in Peru for another death. Name was Vandersloot. He's got a 28-year sentence for another mysterious death. And then, of course, we have the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. March 8th, 2014. That's a day with more questions than answers. Plenty of theories exist for why Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared with 227 passengers and 12 crew members. But there's never been a single sign of wreckage or anything else to indicate the plane crashed. And since parts of the airplane haven't been found in the water along the flight path, it would suggest the plane was not where the authorities believed it was going to be. Searching for thousands of square miles of suggested flight paths has not revealed any answers. Now, it was an international passenger flight flying from Kuala Lumpur International Airport to Beijing International Airport. Air traffic control heard from the flight at 1:19 Malaysia time, or 17:19 Universal time. Flight was over the South China Sea. They'd been in the air less than an hour. Air traffic control had the flight on the radar screen and contact was made. But 2 minutes later, at 1:21 Malaysia time, the plane vanished off the radar screens. The Malaysia military radar continued to track the flight even while the airport couldn't. According to the military radar, the plane deviated from the flight path before disappearing at 2:22. The radar tracked it to the Andaman Sea, about 200 nautical miles to the northwest of Penang. Penang is in northwest Malaysia. A global effort was put together in order to find the plane. Ships, helicopters, and other equipment were brought into the Gulf of Thailand and the South China Sea. Investigation started when the radar lost the plane. When no signs of debris from an airplane crash in the water was located, the search was extended to the Andaman Sea and the Strait of Malacca. The Malaysian government released data suggesting the plane was in the air in the late 19 Malaysian time, despite a lack of communication from the pilot, co-pilots, or other crew members. Suggested at the time the flight flew over the southern Indian Ocean, but no details on the precise location could be determined. Australia took over the head of the investigation on March 17th. On March 24th, the Malaysian government announced the final location based on satellite communication shows the plane to be far from any possible landing site the plane might have used. Folks are still on the plane being somewhere in the ocean, particularly in the southern Indian Ocean. Well, the search for Flight 370 has been the largest aviation search in history. What makes this so mysterious is the complete and total lack of debris. No evidence the plane went down in any of the seas or ocean. One time it was suggested an oil slick might be related to the plane, but a further search of the area didn't recover any conclusive evidence the plane fell in one piece to the ocean floor in that area. All the families of those on board are still waiting for answers. And there were some prominent people on board. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We're going to be talking tomorrow night about the Battle of Los Angeles. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.